Okay. So, why don't we begin? I'm Joe Moore in the philosophy department here at Amherst, and I want to welcome you to the first of five talks in our speaker series this year, Rationality and Religious Belief. I want to thank Professor Katya Rubova for organizing the series, and the Forey and Micken Fund in Philosophy and Science for funding it. I'm very pleased to have as our first speaker an international invitee who came all the way in from Nova Scotia, Steve Mason from the University of Arcadia. And Steve is the W.G. Clark Professor of Philosophy. Steve specializes in epistemology and also philosophy of religion, has written widely in both areas. Another interest of his, though, is the relation between religion and morality, which he's going to speak to us about today, God versus morality. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe, for that introduction. Can you hear me all the way in the back? Am I audible? Okay, terrific. Put your hand up if at any time you can't hear me, and I'll just talk louder. It's an honor and a privilege to have been invited to speak here, and it is also a great relief to be here. This talk very nearly didn't happen. Evidently, God does not want me to give this talk, and his instrument is Air Canada, but I made it here anyway. I've got some preparatory slides here just to make sure the equipment's working, but I love this line. I don't know if you've seen books where on a page is printed, this page intentionally left blank. That's one of my favorites. I get a kick out of that. It's a pragmatic or a performative contradiction, so I couldn't resist using it. Okay, so the topic today is God versus morality. And when you contemplate that slide, I know what you must be thinking. Where the hell is Nova Scotia? And where the hell is Acadia University? I can help. Okay, so these are the Canadian Maritime Provinces. Nova Scotia is off the coast of Maine, across the Bay of Fundy. It's a part of Canada that's tucked out of the way. It's a small market. As a result, Air Canada doesn't have much competition, and they treat us with contempt. But I digress. And Acadia University is located in pretty much the geographic center of the province. So it's out of the way, but it's not the Great White North. We're actually south of Portland, Oregon, in terms of latitude. But we are out of the way. Okay, God versus morality. Thank you for coming to this talk. Let me set the context a bit. This, of course, is a talk in a series on rationality and religious belief. I want to commend the organizers of the series for having chosen an extremely important topic, arguably the world's most important topic right now. And this topic has an importance that took a lot of scholars by surprise. 40, 50 years ago, scholars were predicting the demise of religion as an influence geopolitically. And those predictions turned out to be extremely mistaken. I'd argue that no topic has more contemporary domestic within the U.S., within North America more generally, and international political significance than that topic. So once again, I commend the organizers for having chosen it. Okay, the late James Rachels, American moral philosopher, ethicist from Alabama, wrote this a few years ago in his widely used textbook on moral philosophy. Quoting, "It's not unusual for priests and ministers to be treated as moral experts when the prestigious National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research was organized in the mid-1970s. Two seats on the commission were reserved for ethicists. Those seats went to a Jesuit priest and a professor at the Pacific School of Religion, notably not to James Rachel's. And I'm not sure he ever got over that. So this is the context in which I'm going to situate my talk, one in which religious figures are accorded moral expertise because they are religious authorities. Here's an example closer to my own home. In fact, literally 200 yards down the street from where I live in Halifax is the Canadian Center for Ethics and Public Affairs, whose mission is as follows. They undertake collaborative research and education on ethics and promote the public good through the cultivation and dissemination of knowledge of ethical issues. Well, their board of directors is interesting. It consists of four business people, two management consultants, one business professor, three theologians, one professor of religious studies, and a graduate student in theology. So not a single philosopher sits on the board of the Canadian Center for Ethics and Public Affairs, or ever has sat on the board of that public organization. I find that puzzling. Rachel's does too, and he asks this, why are clergymen regarded in this way? His diagnosis is that in popular thinking, morality and religion are inseparable. People commonly believe that morality can be understood only in the context of theism, belief in God. The context of the quotation actually has to do with Christian theism in particular, but at least theism is the presupposed context for morality in much of the world. Here's more context. As you may have heard, atheists are the most distrusted minority group in America among the groups studied by sociologists at the University of Minnesota in a now famous study. The reason most respondents gave for distrusting atheists is that only believers in God are morally trustworthy. And this is a line of thinking that goes way back. You can find it in John Locke among philosophers, and certainly in popular thinking. But I want to argue something quite to the contrary. I'm going to argue that it's not atheism that's bad for morality. In fact, it's theism that's bad for morality. So I'm going to try to turn the tables here. Okay, there are three different basic perspectives you might take on the relationship of God to morality. One is that God's existence is necessary for morality. This is, as I've just indicated, a very popular position. It's a position held by some philosophers, though I would not say by most, but it's extremely popular among the public. A second position, I think this probably is the opinion held by most philosophers, is that God's existence is neutral here. It's neither necessary for morality nor inconsistent with morality. But I'm going to try to defend a stronger position than that. I'm going to argue that God's existence is, in fact, inconsistent with morality. You can have morality or you can have God. You can't have both. Okay, let me start with five theistic threats to morality that I'm not going to be discussing in detail, but we can talk about these in the Q&A if you want. I think they're all interesting issues that deserve to be explored, but I haven't explored them yet, and in some cases I'm not equipped to, but I do want to mention them. Getting killed is good for you. Well, the theistic religions teach a doctrine of heaven, eternal bliss enjoyed by either all who die or some who die. What happens to the morality of killing, then, if all people, or the right kind of people, go to heaven when they're killed? I think this complicates the morality of killing. There's a conceptual issue that needs to be explored here. What happens to morality if our conduct is motivated by thoughts of otherworldly punishment and reward? Does this compromise morality? Does it taint it? Does it make it inauthentic? I think those are interesting conceptual questions, philosophical questions. There is also an empirical question here. How moral are we likely to be, in fact, if our conduct is motivated by distant prospect of reward or punishment? And here I think the signs are not good. Distant reward and punishment have a very weak regulatory effect. But that's an empirical issue that someone ought to explore. This is perhaps what you expected me to talk about when you saw God versus morality, religious violence. What role does theistic belief, belief in God, play in motivating intentional harm, such as religiously motivated terrorism and genocide? That, I think, is an empirical question to be investigated. But I'm not going to talk at length about it here. How does belief in God affect the personal responsibility that people are willing to accept? So I chose a quotation here from among any number that I could have chosen. You may remember the conflict in Lebanon a few years back. Here's a quotation from the Associated Press. "God made this decision for me," said Onavi, a grandfather and one of the oldest volunteers. "I still have fight left in me for a holy war. It's not my decision, it's God's decision." I think that kind of thinking is not uncommon. And finally, among the things I'm not going to talk about, some people say that only theism supports the humanistic idea that all human beings, simply because they're human, possess equal dignity and value. I myself am suspicious of that idea. I think it's not particularly plausible as it stands. If theism, in fact, implies it, that might be a reason to reject theism. But I won't argue that here. I'll simply point out that others say theism's glorification of our species encourages immoral treatment of non-human animals, for example, in factory farming and in the testing of cosmetics. Okay, so if I'm not going to talk about those things, what am I going to talk about? This is the thesis I hope to defend here. It's a conceptual claim, not an empirical claim. It's the claim our most serious moral obligations conceptually depend, if you like, logically depend, on atheism, on the claim that no perfect God exists. That's why you would be forced to choose between God and morality. If you want it in the form of a slogan, you can think of it as theism's dilemma. The better God is, the worse we are allowed to be, the easier morality is on us. And of course, because in theism, God is as good as it is possible to be, morality is as easy on us as it's possible to be. So this is a bit of a slogan. I used it about a year ago in a magazine article where I thought it was fitting to include a slogan. But that's sort of the take-home message for this talk. Okay, I'm going to make a couple of important assumptions. I think they will be uncontroversial, but I'm certainly prepared to discuss them. Number one, and I think everybody should sign on to this conditional claim, whether you're theistic or atheistic or somewhere in between, if God exists, then God possesses perfect knowledge, power, and goodness. We are talking about the capital G God of monotheism. So even an atheist, I think, should sign on to this conditional claim. Second, anything deserving the title morality obligates us to prevent the torture of a small child if we can do so easily and at no risk to ourselves. And the more easily we can prevent it, the less risk to ourselves, the stronger is our obligation to prevent it. So I'm going to be operating with those two assumptions for now. Now, unfortunately, this allusion to child torture is not a fictional philosopher's example. So I'm going to acquaint you with the heartbreaking case of Dominic Calhoun. There's a picture of Dominic. in 2010, 4-year-old Dominic Calhoun from a small town in Michigan was beaten and burned to death over several days by his mother's boyfriend. Quote, "This is the worst case of child abuse I've ever seen," said the local police chief. "In all respects, he was tortured." 4-year-old boy. That's heartbreaking. And unfortunately, that sort of thing is far from unique. So, to reiterate what I said already, if you could easily and at no risk to yourself have prevented Dominic's abuse, I say morality would have required you to prevent it. Particularly if it's extremely easy and extremely low risk. That's a moral obligation you have under those circumstances, or so I assert. Okay, so how do we get the result that morality presupposes atheism rather than theism? How do we get the result that morality and theism are incompatible with each other? Well, this way. I'm going to try to establish that if God exists, you couldn't ever have a moral obligation to prevent child torture, no matter how easy it might be to do so and how low risk it might be. And then from there, I would argue, if you couldn't ever have a moral obligation to prevent child torture, ever have such an obligation, then there's nothing left of morality, or nothing left of morality worth caring about, because the rest of it would be comparatively trivial. Suppose you could find a moral obligation not to commit fraud. That would be trivial in comparison to this gaping absence of a moral obligation to prevent child torture. So I'm going to argue that there's nothing left of morality that we should really care about if this obligation goes by the boards. Okay, one important element of my argument is the claim that God can't exploit children. I happen to think God can't exploit any non-volunteer, but in any case can't exploit a non-volunteer, someone who doesn't volunteer to be exploited, particularly if that person is a child. So, I argue, if God possesses perfect knowledge, power, and goodness, then God can't allow a child to suffer involuntarily unless the suffering is needed for, or the best way of securing, the child's greater good. And here I have some support from a number of sources, including a prominent Christian philosopher, Eleanor Stump, who writes as follows. If a good God allows evil, it can only be because the evil in question produces a benefit for the sufferer, and one that God could not produce without the suffering. Elsewhere, she writes, other things being equal, it seems morally permissible to allow someone to suffer involuntarily only in case doing so is a necessary means, or the best possible means in the circumstances, to keep the sufferer from incurring even greater harm. Okay, so this from a major Christian philosopher, but I don't want to appeal to her authority. I think these are extremely plausible statements. So God can't exploit children. To give you a pictorial representation of what I'm saying, this can't be God. God can't be looking upon a child suffering out of curiosity, for entertainment purposes. God can't be allowing a child to suffer except for the net benefit of that very sufferer. Otherwise, God is imperfect in one of the three major respects, power, knowledge, or goodness. So that cartoon can't depict God. All right, so I draw the conclusion then, in this particular case, God permits Dominic Calhoun's suffering only if it's necessary or optimal for securing Dominic's greater good in this life or the next. We leave that open. But his net benefit, ultimately. But if that's the case, then we can't have the obligation that morality says we have, the obligation to prevent Dominic's abuse if we easily can. Why not? Well, I'll draw an analogy here. If God exists, our letting Dominic suffer is like letting him receive a painful vaccination for his net benefit. We don't have a moral obligation to prevent such vaccinations. Sure, vaccinations often hurt. Needles are painful. But when the vaccination confers a serious net benefit on the recipient, at a minimum we say we don't have an obligation to prevent the vaccination. In fact, we go further. We tend to say that parents have an obligation to get the child vaccinated under those circumstances. And anyone who stands in the way of the vaccination is doing something wrong. But at a minimum, we don't have an obligation to prevent vaccinations of that sort. If anything, the contrary. Now, suppose you reject what I've said so far, and you think it's possible to reconcile God's existence with the moral obligation to prevent child torture. I'd like to know how it is you would reconcile those two things, but I think I can say something even in that case. I think even this result would hold were God's existence and the obligation to prevent suffering actually compatible. Even this would hold in that case. What I call it reverse triage. The more extreme a child's suffering, the more reason theism gives, because of God's nature, for thinking that such suffering is needed, or optimal, say, best way of securing the child's well-being. And therefore, the less reason theism gives us to prevent such suffering. So even if God's existence and the obligation to prevent suffering are compatible, we have this bizarre reverse triage. We should attend to trivial cases of suffering first, because they are less likely to be for the child's own good, and leave the severe cases of suffering for last, because those are the most likely to be for the child's own good if God is in charge of things. And that's a bizarre result all on its own. And one, I think, that's just incompatible with anything that ought to be called morality. Okay, let me entertain here six objections to this reasoning and then more objections during the Q&A. See if I can head some things off anyway. Well, why can't a perfect God exploit? I've been asserting that no perfect God can exploit children. Well, why not? Richard Swinburne, retired philosopher from Oxford University, holds that God has moral permission to exploit any human being because all human beings owe their existence to God. God is, on balance, their benefactor. And furthermore, quoting him, being of use is a good for the victim who gets used. So Swinburne takes a hard line here. An absolutely perfect God can indeed exploit any of us for ulterior purposes. Let's see if I can test that proposition. So imagine that I clone a child into existence from a single one of my skin cells. So I'm going to try to get as close to creation as I can. And I treat the child splendidly for all but the final 1 minute of its life. During that final minute, I let someone abuse the child to death in order to show onlookers just how revolting child abuse is, and thereby deter them from ever abusing a child. So I have a reason for allowing this to occur. It's to deter child abuse, protect other children. Do I act acceptably here? I say no. Do I act with moral perfection? Far from it. I think this is morally monstrous. I am abusing or I'm exploiting that child for ends that do not justify the exploitation. But if Swinburne is right, we should at least imagine that I act correctly in these conditions of by behaving that way, but I can't imagine that I could. So I think that Swinburne's principle is open to obvious counterexamples. All right, number two, what about autonomy? I haven't mentioned autonomy yet. I've been talking about net benefit. what if we could rescue the moral obligation from the threat posed by theism this way? We have a moral obligation to prevent Dominic's abuse, even if we know it ultimately benefits him because the abuse is against his will. He doesn't want to be abused. And that's a sufficient reason for our obligation to prevent it. The abuse violates his autonomy, end of story. Never mind whether it benefits him in the end. That's not the point. It's a violation of his autonomy. That's impermissible. We are therefore obligated to prevent it. I don't think this line of reasoning works either. Because, get back to the vaccination case. Suppose instead of abuse, Dominic had been unwilling to receive a vaccination for his own benefit. Plenty of kids are. In that case, no one would have had a moral obligation to prevent his vaccination, even though he doesn't want a vaccination. And yet in both cases, autonomy is equally present or absent, depending on your point of view. Yet they differ morally. We have an obligation to prevent Dominic's torture, no obligation to prevent his beneficial vaccination. Autonomy is doing no work here. Autonomy doesn't explain the moral difference here. What does explain it? The extreme net harm that torture will cause Dominic, or so we think, versus the net benefit that vaccination will confer on him. And I've been arguing, in essence, that extreme net harm can't happen to Dominic if God exists. No perfect God could allow extreme net harm, all things considered, to befall an innocent child. So autonomy doesn't work, I think, as a reply. This objection comes up every time I talk about anything like this topic. This is by far the most popular objection. Free will. The boyfriend tortured Dominic out of his own free will. It's a free agent. And God, according to this line of thinking, may justly sacrifice Dominic as the price to be paid for his abuser's exercise of free will on that occasion. The alternative was interfering with the abuser's free will, and that's a no-go zone. So it's too bad for Dominic. The price to be paid is his suffering. I'm frankly amazed how often I hear this reply. For consider, God's allowing child abuse, child torture, so as not to interfere with the abuser's freedom. That's a clear case of exploiting a child for some other end that's woefully insufficient as an end, and that's something that no perfect being could do. And furthermore, this kind of reasoning is totally alien to common sense morality. So again, I can't understand why it comes up so often in the context of God and morality. As I say here, the frequent theistic refrain about the sacrosanct, untouchable value of human freedom shows just how alien theism is to our ordinary moral outlook. Theism evidently invites people to say this sort of thing about free will, but that's totally at odds with how we regard free will in our ordinary moral discourse. We don't think it goes on the positive side of the ledger that the abuser tortured Dominic freely. We don't think that's a good thing. Had he been compelled to torture Dominic, that would have been even worse. And we certainly don't say the abuser's freedom must not be violated under any circumstances. On the contrary, we violate people's freedom all the time and are often morally obligated to do it, including in cases of the kind I've been describing. So, for all its popularity, I think the free will objection is a total failure. Okay, fourth is an objection that I label heaven swamps everything. And the idea is this: big enough compensation paid to an exploited person sometimes justifies the exploitation. And of course, heaven is the biggest possible compensation. Doesn't get any better than heaven. So the biggest possible compensation will just swamp any exploitation you were forced to endure and somehow thereby justify the original exploitation. And I don't see how this works. So the idea here is even though Dominic's suffering isn't necessary for him to attain heaven, heaven is big enough compensation that God is morally off the hook for what he allows Dominic to endure. This objection seems to me confused. I think it's mistaking two quite distinct things, compensation and justification. So if I run you over carelessly in my car, the law may very well make me compensate you. But no amount of compensation that I pay is going to justify my conduct. I was negligent. I was reckless and irresponsible. And we don't make that not the fact if I buy you off with enough money. Or if a billionaire abuses children sexually and then pays the children and their families lots of hush money. The families go away quietly. Nothing is ever heard about it. Nobody thinks that justifies the original sexual exploitation. So compensation is just very different from justification. And heaven swamps everything conflates those two different things. Or else maybe, and this is an inclusive or, could be doing both of these things, maybe it mistakes the blissful heaven dweller's willingness to forgive for a moral justification of his or her suffering. So in heaven, things are so blissful, you're not holding any grudges, all is forgiven, all wrongs are forgiven. Does that constitute a justification for those original wrongs? I don't see how. Forgiveness is not the same as justification. Those are different concepts. So I sense a confusion here as well. So I don't find heaven swamps anything, everything, to be persuasive. And finally, among the objections that I will... Actually, no, there are six of them. Next to last. God's commands. Here is a way that some say we can rescue the moral obligation that I've said theism threatens by appealing to God's commands. Maybe you want to grant, even if God's existence would otherwise relieve us of a moral obligation to prevent Dominic's suffering, fortunately, God's commands impose such an obligation. You might say, granted, if there were no divine commands, we wouldn't have an obligation to rescue Dominic, because obviously his exploitation must be for his own net good. But God has brought commands into the mix, and he has told us to prevent suffering of this sort. So we're obligated. I don't find that this works either. For one thing, it conflicts with our moral outlook, our ordinary moral outlook, by locating the wrongness of our inaction, right? The wrongness of our failing to intervene to help Dominic in what it does to God rather than what it does to Dominic, whom it benefits. So the reason our inaction, we stand by and watch Dominic be tortured, the reason it's wrong according to this line is not what it does to Dominic. He's actually better off as a result. It's because we offended God by failing to obey one of his commands. That seems to me to locate the wrongness in the wrong place. If our inaction is wrong, it's wrong principally because of what it does to its victim. That's what the ordinary moral outlook would say. We let Dominic down. But if theism is true, in fact, Dominic is no worse off and arguably must be better off as a result of our inaction. Furthermore, if the command really is prevent beneficial suffering, then it's an odd command. That torture will benefit Dominic in the end. It's necessary or optimal for his net benefit. Prevent it anyway. That's an odd command, at the very least. There is a command you can tease out of the scriptures to the effect that we ought to show compassion. There are also plenty of commands to the contrary, that we should lack compassion. But you can find show compassion in there. But of course, that doesn't mean show misguided compassion. It's not the command to run around preventing beneficial vaccinations because they hurt. That would be misguided compassion. Someone who spent his or her time preventing important vaccinations would be misguided. Now, you may think vaccinations are, in fact, harmful, all things considered, but I'm talking about a case in which the vaccination is beneficial. It's not the part of compassion to go preventing those vaccinations because needles hurt. And I put it to the challenger, where has God commanded us to prevent suffering? That's surprisingly hard to find in the monotheistic scriptures, for example. And if you can find something to that effect, it's alongside innumerable injunctions to inflict suffering. So if we are serious about divine commands, we need to try to find it. And that's no easy feat. Okay, last objection. I've assumed from the get-go that we're talking about a perfect God, the capital G perfect God of monotheism. Well, you might say, look, our moral obligations survive. They're untouched if God lacks any of perfect knowledge, perfect power, or perfect goodness. Because if God lacks any of those three, my argument doesn't go through. So the solution here is just believe in an imperfect God. I think that's easier said than done. Let me remark, first of all, that it merely changes the subject to say the God of monotheism, that's not my God. I've been talking about the relationship between the God of monotheism and morality. If you want to talk about something else, that's fine, but don't pretend that we're talking about the subject I started with. I've argued that a perfect God destroys anything recognizable as morality on our part. But let me query this some more. I mean, once you begin admitting God's imperfections, where do you stop? Why think that a God lacking one of the divine perfections, perfect power, for example, would possess any of the others? Typically, in the philosophical tradition, these divine perfections are treated as a package deal. The reason for deducing one of the divine perfections is equally a reason for deducing the rest of them. They tend to stand or fall together. So once you begin chiseling away at the traditional concept, where do you stop? I don't see any non-arbitrary place to stop. And furthermore, if you're moved by child suffering to retreat on the concept of God, to think of God as somehow imperfect, because otherwise, how could Dominic have been allowed to suffer? You're admitting that child suffering is some reason to conclude that God is imperfect. But if that's the case, it's reason to conclude that God is radically imperfect. Because imagine yourself in that situation. You can prevent the torture easily and at no risk to yourself. You can never prevent it as easily and at as little risk as God can. It's always less risky for him, personally. But if you fail to prevent it under those circumstances, we don't think you're just short of perfection. We think you're morally callous or indifferent or monstrous. You're way, way far from perfection. So I think if you're going to admit that child suffering is a reason to retreat from the traditional concept of God, it becomes a reason to retreat so far that you're left with a God that's of no religious interest. Okay. Thank you very much for listening.
Theism you fairly characterize is really representative of religious belief, contemporary religious belief, and it certainly don't think it's representative of theological scholarship over the past 100 years.
Which of the three divine perfections have I mistakenly assumed God possesses?
I just don't think that God figures prominently in a lot of theological writing and thinking over the past century. I really don't. I think, you know, you'd probably find, according to your definition, you'd probably find a lot of atheists in theology departments, and even in divinity schools for that matter.
What about the ordinary believer in the pew? Are they atheists too?
According to your definition, possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I would put it to them.
At least the churches that I've attended.
Okay. Well, I would put it to such a believer. What prompts you to retreat on the classical definition? And if it's something like a problem of evil, and it. That kind of response has come up when I've given versions of this talk. I've had people say to me, of course God isn't perfect. And so I begin to explore that. Which of the divine perfections prevent, the lack of which perfection explains his failure to intervene? I've heard it said that, well, he'd like to intervene, he knows how, but he's not powerful enough to. And the rest of it. I think once you begin retreating, though, you get, in that case, a pretty impotent God.
I would agree with you all.
All right, and what reason then to think that he possesses any of these perfections? He has none of them.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay, so he's beginning to sound like a. Is he created?
Sorry.
Is he created or uncreated? Does God? Did he come into being? This imperfect God you're talking about. Because it sounds like
I'm not
an
talking about the imperfect God. I'm just saying that God is absent from the discussion altogether. And it's a tough question.
In some theological circles, he might be, but God isn't absent from discussions in churches all across America, right? I mean,
sure.
Okay, so are they're talking about an imperfect God in that case, a God who lacks one or all of those three perfections.
Right.
Okay, so then all sorts of awkward questions arise. Is this God merely an extraterrestrial, a very powerful alien being who evolved from earlier species? It becomes fair game to ask. If God's an alien, then we can ask such questions as how old is he? What did he evolve from? Where does he live? What's the extent of his control? Classical theism finesses all of that, gets rid of all those awkward questions by saying he didn't evolve, he never came into existence, he always was or exists timelessly. There is no real limit to his power, knowledge, or goodness, and dismisses those questions. But they become very real, pressing, awkward questions that we conceive of God as an alien creature or an alien being, which is, sounds like what you described.
Okay, we're
going to
have this very back and forth off because we
sorry.
Have lots of questions to go. So I'm
going to
go with one more student question.
What I think you're doing is that my flaw is that you're attempting to talk about God in theory and not about like what he actually is in practice and what people believe. Because you're attempting to rationalize God, which is impossible because if you like take one of the like, monotheistic religions, let's say Christianity, for example, the Bible says, Isaiah 55:8 says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways, declares the Lord. But therefore, like you can't rationalize what he does. Like your attempt to rationalize his principles is therefore impossible.
Yeah, it sounds to me as if you're using reasoning, you're rationalizing yourself. In light of that scripture from Isaiah, you're interpreting it. It says something about God, and certain things follow logically from what it says. Like God is going to be mysterious, he's going to puzzle us. That's, of course, reasoning. You're drawing inferences from those claims about God. So I think it's impossible not to rationalize about God. To decline to apply reason to
to God or to religious propositions. You gave me some reason from Isaiah to suppose that God will be mysterious and inscrutable. But we just had a rational meeting of the minds. We used our reason. So I think declaring reason off limits is, it's impossible to make good on that. What follows from it? You need to use reason to get there. Plus which, if we do begin to debate scriptures, there are all sorts of attributions of righteousness and goodness to God in the scriptures. And if God is as mysterious as you're suggesting he must be, then it becomes very hard to interpret those attributions of goodness and righteousness. What do they mean? What do they come to? Could it be the very height of righteousness on God's part deliberately to allow Dominic to suffer for no good reason? And if it couldn't be, why not? If God's so inscrutable, why couldn't it be the height of his righteousness to allow Dominic to suffer for God's entertainment? We can't see how that could fail to be monstrous. But of course we can't. God's mysterious. So it's a dangerous way to go, I think. It's very hard to apply this line that rationality has no place here. Making God mysterious threatens so much of what the scriptures are supposed to teach us about God. So that would be my response.
Yes.
Sympathetic to your enlightenment pathos, so in the general idea that I think it's the task of the philosophers to try to engage this issue so as to release the idea, or sort of disentangle the idea that we need a religious foundation for morality. So as far as the basic setup is concerned, we're on the same ground, but I'm very dissatisfied with the way that you set up this talk, because it seems to me convincing philosophers or secular intellectuals is one thing, but how can this kind of argumentation possibly engage somebody who's, this is a little bit echoing the student question, who really lives the kind of general life of somebody in faith? Because your way of setting up the Theodicea problem, for example, by quoting this modern theologian who argues from a kind of utilitarian perspective, it wouldn't really. The classic solution to Theodicea, and you know this also, is saying that God has given man a certain freedom. And why has he given freedom? Well, in order to participate in the creation, which means also the possibility of sin.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in this terrible example that you have shown here is, of course, from the Christian perspective, an example of sin. This is a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to sin within the context of faith and religion. So I cannot see how your theological argument would convince anybody. If you really want to sort of fight for a kind of philosophical enlightenment program, then you can do it more perhaps in the light of Nietzsche, trying to make people see the genealogy of our values and the mythology behind the idea of some kind of initial command. But doing it in this very formal way seems, in a sense, just it evaporates. Or what's your experience when you do this talk before congregations? I mean, the normal, many kind of people that you meet, for example, in the United States, does this work? It seems to be more like a philosophical game.
It is a philosophy talk, and the reaction varies. But I do try to explore this notion that free will is at the heart of the solution here. And I think it doesn't solve the problem that I pose, which is this conflict between theism and morality. If anything, it illustrates the conflict. Because the line you're taking seems to assign very much more importance and weight to free will and free action than we actually assign when we're evaluating agents morally.
But you agree with me that the normal response for a believer would be precisely to say that this is an act of sin, right?
That's right. Which
we
sounds
to itself possibly this person for being saved, etc. But that's the mythology of it. But you can couch it within a religious outlook.
Yes, but I think that invocation of sin there is another illustration of how alien theism is to our ordinary moral outlook, because a sin is first and foremost an offense against God. That's what's wrong with sin, primarily. It's disobedient to God. It's an offense against your Creator. And only secondarily is it wrong. Well, think of it this way. It wouldn't be wrong at all if there were no God. It wouldn't be a sin, strictly speaking. So God's essential to its being a sin. But when we evaluate cruelty on the part of human agents, we think first and foremost of their victims. They're the primary locus of wrongness when someone gets tortured. It's not some third party's being offended or disobeyed. If I torture a child, I've done wrong first and foremost to the child and only indirectly or secondarily to the criminal code or something else. So I think invocation of sin is another illustration of the mismatch between theistic thinking and the way we think the rest of the day when we're not thinking in that way, when we actually evaluate agents.
To predicate the existence of God is to do a dangerous thing. It's to render God an object among objects. Paul Tillich used to talk about the God above gods, all the non-gods that we worship. I'm fascinated with the writings of Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne, and process theologians who do not objectify God. And I suppose my sense of God is the tug of the future upon us, or are that which inspires human beings to seek that which is of ultimate value. We make mistakes in doing so. But whatever it is, that impulse that inspires us to see that which is best and that which is good, I don't think it changes the subject. I think it removes it from the subject.
Changes it radically, makes it unrecognizable to the believer in the pew.
Not in my experience. I'm
okay.
A clergy person. I've had considerable experience with people in pews.
So when George W. Bush claims to be talking to God, he's talking to the tug of the future, or whatever it was that you said.
Where there is that in us and in the world which moves people toward that which is better. How we define that which is better, how we respond to that is the key issue, I believe.
Is there any reason to think
God is not a thing among things? If anything, God is a spirit.
Okay.
And Scripture says that.
Sure. No. And nothing I've said to the contrary.
God is spirit and truth.
So George W. Bush took himself to be addressing an entity of the sort you're describing. Not even an entity, really.
Tillich's comment is perfect. It's perfect. There is a God above gods. That God cannot be objected. That is that which moves us in this direction of seeking that which is best.
I could
anyway,
respond.
Let's
take more. Yeah, sure.
Forward, so let's move on.
I'm here all night if you want me to be.
My question is, if we accept your theory, I guess, that theism and morality are incompatible, my question would be, where is morality?
Do you mean where do things like moral talk and behavior, moral practices, or moral standards come from?
Because like it seems to me that everyone in this room knows that what happened to Dominic was absolutely awful. And like, where does that thought come from?
Psychologically?
I guess. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I couldn't say it. What makes moral standards objective?
Yeah.
That's a great big meta-ethical topic among philosophers, and well and ably discussed by the philosophers in Amherst's philosophy department. So.
All right.
It's too big for me to go in here, into here. I'm taking it already as given that anything that deserves the title morality really does obligate us under certain circumstances. How that could come to be is a different question. In a way, I think you may be agreeing with the central point of my talk, which is that the obligation we think we begin with turns out to be threatened in surprising ways, perhaps, by the notion that there's a God in charge of it all. I'm not an anthropologist, so I can't speak to the evolution on cultures of moral standards and so on, but my sense is that ordinary morality develops independently from any sorts of considerations of a perfect being in charge of it all. And once you bring that kind of being in, you can make a hash of what you thought was true on the moral side. Now, I'm not sure I'm getting at your distinction between a strict and a consequential obligation, but I don't think that's essential to what you were saying.
Well, I guess if by like a strict obligation, I take it to be like a duty of some sort, like in which case
okay. It
doesn't matter what the consequences of your actions
yeah.
are.
Yeah, I don't think that dovetails with common sense morality either, because we do give thought to the consequences when we assess our duties to intervene. So you see a child getting a painful needle against measles or polio, and knowing what you know, you don't think you have an obligation to prevent that vaccination because you have a perfect duty to prevent suffering when you can. So you do reason with the consequences. My claim is that is what's always going on if God is in charge. Otherwise, it would be exploitation.
So I'm going to insert my own question. I'm going to use my power.
Exploit it. Yeah, okay.
I'm going to follow myself. And I just wanted you to tell us about what exactly, how closely related your argument is to the problem of evil. Because they're very similar, but I was wondering what the difference between distinctive or different.
Yeah, I guess I got tired of debating the standard problem of evil and moved a little bit elsewhere, a little to the side, just began to take seriously the responses one gets to the traditional problem of evil and examine the effect of those responses or the relationship of those responses to what I keep calling ordinary morality. And a number of those responses on behalf of theism turn out to be quite hostile to our ordinary moral thinking. So I began, as many people do, reading and talking and writing and thinking about the problem of evil, and found myself convinced I could make headway on a different issue. Now, maybe I can't. Maybe I am describing a kind of God who's totally alien to ordinary believers and even more alien to sophisticated theologians. I took myself to be describing the capital G God that my relatives on both sides of my family worship and tell me about all the time. They do not backtrack on God's knowledge, power, or goodness. God is perfect in all of those respects. And so it must be something to do with free will. That's typically the response I get. So, anyway, that's how it originated. And I was thinking I could make some headway on a different issue this way.
Well, what's philosophically the thing? Your conclusion seems stronger, is that right?
Well, if there is indeed this conflict between morality and God's existence, then you can't have it both ways. So you could look at it as an argument for God's non-existence. Surely we have these ordinary moral obligations, but we don't if God exists, so there is no God. That's one way to work it. But I consider my work done if I've convinced people of the incompatibility, and they can resolve it whichever way they want.
Okay.
I guess I'm not sure if this will make sense. I guess when I was religious, I always thought of God as like kind of the man that I would go see when I died, and he would kind of hold up my good deeds and my bad deeds, and whichever was heavier, that would decide where I went, like to heaven or hell. But I guess the reason I think that morality is inconsistent with that type of God is because if you're doing something morally without God in the picture, and you're doing it because it's right, and not because you expect a reward that's going to be left.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I would think that would be a stronger argument
for
God rather than kind of a textbook Bible definition.
Okay, is it a version of this concern?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's to be explored. Yeah, that's a live issue. Might have been, but chose to go elsewhere.
I was wondering whether you, it seems like an issue that sort of brought some questions about whether you find or whether you think that there's sort of like a terminology problem that is often had when people use the same word God in so many different ways, and that perhaps maybe people are you assuming that there's a disagreement when there is none, or that there is an agreement when there is actually a disagreement? Is they are not fully agreed upon what they actually mean when they say God? And I was wondering what you sort of think about that issue.
That's why I took the trouble to say this much about what I meant by God. Now, I could be out to lunch where that's concerned. This seems pretty standard to me in respect of the supreme being of monotheism. But I recognize people use that term God in a number of different ways, so I wanted to say very early on, this is how I use it. And I don't think I'm alone. I think a lot of ordinary believers and even some theologians use the term that way. And again, there is this worry. If you begin to defend the existence of an imperfect God, all sorts of awkward questions come up about this alien with limited reach. What species does it belong to? Why doesn't it belong to a species if it doesn't? I mean, you get a whole bunch of awkward and embarrassing and difficult questions that the classical concept of God is designed to head off. So there's a worry there, a substantial worry if you do back off from the tri-omni concept of God.
I'm curious if you structured your whole argument around the example of the partner and the child and argued that if God exists, then we can't have the obligation to prevent that harm. It doesn't seem to me like just by doing a sort of copy-paste, you could apply the same argument to a moral obligation to refrain from actually doing harm. And I'm wondering if you've thought about that, and maybe there is a way to finesse the arguments in order to show that, well, if God refrain from causing certain kinds of harm.
Yeah, it has crossed my mind. I haven't really thought about it carefully enough to see if that will work. I haven't really considered objections to that line of reasoning in particular. this seemed to me bad enough. If I could get folks to accept this dilemma, that would be an important step forward, but it could be even worse than I've made it out to be. Yeah.
Thank you.
collide with our intuitions, because we generally believe that's something that we should do. If it, right, I mean, that we all generally believe that we should prevent child suffering, if it's easy, it's in line with our intuitions, what we believe. If it's true that God is all-powerful, and he controls all instances of child suffering, so he has the option to prevent that suffering from happening or to make that suffering happen, then isn't it also God who has given us the intuition to intervene? Like, perhaps God believes that there is some long-term benefit to teaching us to be an active bystander. It seems to me that we believe that God is entirely in control when it comes to the imposition or prevention of suffering, but somehow the choice of whether or not the bystander should intervene is completely up to us. So it seems like in one realm you're affirming theological determinism, but at the same time when it comes to what I should do, should I intervene, suddenly God's not in control of my intuitions, I can just choose to do what I want.
I took that to be the standard theistic story. Whether or not it hangs together is another issue, but is the position you've described?
I guess my question is, if it is true that God is in control of the instance of child suffering,
right,
then isn't it also, and it's true that we have this intuition that we should intervene to prevent child suffering, isn't it true that God has given us that intuition? So the fact that we have that intuition means that, I guess, like, descriptively, we have the obligation to intervene.
He's also given us the power to reflect rationally on that intuition and to discover that it's misplaced if God exists. That's been my argument. So if you think about the intuition, you discover, wait a minute, I'm inclined to show misguided compassion. Or at the very least, I don't have the obligation I think I have. Maybe I can intervene or not. Either way, God's going to make sure Dominic does not suffer net harm in the end. But I certainly don't have an obligation to intervene. And you can reason yourself into that position by thinking about what follows from the existence of a perfect God. So he's given us that ability as well. And I'm trying to raise people's consciousness a little bit about how this follows, it seems to me, from classical theism.
Does it
happen
here?
Yeah, I think some of the aspects are important. I can really understand your answer. But what's wrong with just saying that God works in ways that we can't comprehend, so that's why the omnipotent, omnipotent, whatever God can allow child suffering to happen?
Yeah, it's a two-part response, one of which focused on your use of the word so. God works in mysterious ways, therefore, I'm not sure what follows. A really mysterious God is one about whom we can't draw any conclusions. But even if you think we can, we've got to try to reconcile this view with the very confident assertions of God's righteousness and goodness, for example, that you get in the scriptural tradition. Time and again, God is held up as righteous and good, and the question becomes, what does that even mean if, on God's part, it could be totally mysterious? For all we know, taking pleasure in child suffering is the height of goodness when God takes pleasure in it. And I can't really make sense of that problem. So it's a worrisome place to start. Can you begin to draw inferences having declared that God is truly mysterious in the first place? And if you're allowed to draw any inferences, how do you square them with other things about God that we'd like to believe on the basis of revealed religion, for example? Or a friend of yours is saved from cancer, and you're inclined to chalk that up to God's intervention. But a totally mysterious God can't be relied upon to save people from cancer any more than to give them cancer.
Can I just add something to that response? The appeal to the mysterious ways of God often seems like an ad hoc response to solve problems that otherwise seem irresolvable. And no one appeals to the mysteries of God when they're trying to draw implications of God. When they're trying to draw implications about what their commitment to theism requires them to do. And so the question is, you know, for those who want to appeal to the mystery of God's ways, why in some contexts one is justified in doing so and in other contexts not. And you can't just do it when you have a problem, right? And but when you don't have a problem and everything conforms to your beliefs, then all of a sudden God's not mysterious. It's really clear what God wants you to do.
Thank you.
Okay, so in the premise where you state what's the moral, are you asserting that how the moral an act is or the degree to which it is immoral is contingent on a number of bystanders?
I didn't mean to assert it. I just imagined us, any one of us, in a position easily and at no risk to himself or herself to prevent Dominic's torture. Yeah, so there you are, maybe all by yourself. But for some reason or another, you can easily and at no risk to yourself prevent the torture. I might have to tell a fancier story, but it wouldn't be that difficult to do. And you decline to prevent it because you're curious about what child torture looks like, or you don't like getting involved, or maybe you're convinced by another reason. You feel you have no obligation to be involved. Certainly in the first two instances, I'd be inclined to accuse you of morally reprehensible conduct.
Because the reason I ask is because if we were basing this on the idea of an unlimited amount of children, I might be able to like wrap my head around, well, sorry, unlimited potential of immortality associated with an act. I can understand that, but if we were basing this on the idea that that this act had like finite amount of immortality associated with it, then I think by blaming the bystander, you would, in essence, be deflecting blame from the abuser. It just—it almost feels like it's like one step down from victim blame.
Yeah, I don't mean to absolve your mother's boyfriend of blame. He is principally to blame, but so would someone else be to blame who could have stopped it easily and at no risk. And the problems. At least I take that to be an ordinary moral intuition or judgment.
So you're saying that the more bystanders we add on, the more blame that becomes associated with the act, and the more overall amount of immortality associated with the act?
I'm not sure what to say about that. So I'll decline to answer now, unless you can persuade me that I have to answer that question in order to make sense of my original view. I took myself to be saying something really uncontroversial when I said this. Never mind bystanders, too many bystanders and the rest of it. But maybe I'm required to say something on that issue from this elementary starting point.
I wasn't entirely convinced that it would be immoral to just not be involved in something. But
imagine yourself, I'll cook up the story. You can push a button or wave your hand or whistle. Happens, the torturer is phobic about whistling. You can whistle away and you decide not to. I don't even need to hear the reasons in order to take a very dim view of you as a moral agent.
Okay, so before God blesses the electricity anymore, I think I should take our speaker to dinner. So let's say
thank you.